What if I told you that offering someone a massive bonus might actually make them perform worse? That the very incentives we've built our economy around could be sabotaging the outcomes we seek? This counterintuitive reality sits at the heart of human irrationality, a fascinating terrain where our assumptions about logic, motivation, and decision-making crumble under scrutiny. We like to think we're rational creatures, carefully weighing costs and benefits before acting. Yet the truth is far messier and infinitely more interesting. Our brains didn't evolve to maximize efficiency or make perfect choices. They evolved to navigate a complex social world where emotions, meaning, and connection matter as much as cold calculation. Understanding this gap between who we think we are and who we actually are isn't just intellectually fascinating, it's the key to designing better lives, workplaces, and societies. Psychology experiments with rats revealed something counterintuitive. Mild electric shocks improved maze learning, but intense shocks made them freeze. This same pattern appears in humans, with major implications for how we structure rewards. In rural India, participants tackled cognitive tasks for different stakes: small bonuses, 1 day's wages, medium, 2 weeks' pay, or massive, 5 months' salary. Those offered enormous bonuses performed worst, succeeding less than a third as often as other groups. The pressure created such stress that participants choked. MIT studies revealed the boundaries. For purely mechanical tasks like rapid keyboard clicking, bigger bonuses helped. But once even basic thinking entered, simple math problems, larger incentives became counterproductive. Massive executive bonuses meant to sharpen decision-making might actually cloud judgment when clarity matters most. Studies of NDA clutch players showed they didn't improve under pressure. They simply took more shots with the same success rate. Rather than creating superhuman focus, massive incentives generate counterproductive anxiety, pulling attention away from the task and toward the potential windfall or devastating loss. On a flight, a stranger asked what I do, that inevitable question revealing how central work is to our identity. But what happens when work feels meaningless, regardless of pay? A former student, David, spent 10 weeks at an investment bank crafting an elaborate merger presentation. His boss praised it, but the deal was canceled. All that effort served no purpose. He posed a thought experiment. Imagine creating work that's immediately deleted despite excellent pay. How happy would you be? Surprisingly, inspiration came from pet parrots, who preferred working for food rather than eating it freely. This contra-freeloading phenomenon, where animals choose effort over ease, contradicts everything economics tells us about minimizing effort. Experiments using Lego robots revealed meaning's power. Participants in a meaningful condition built robots that were stored, while those in a Sisyphean condition watched theirs immediately disassembled. The meaningful group built 50% more robots despite identical pay. Most telling, people who loved Legos built significantly more in meaningful conditions, but this passion vanished when work felt pointless. Another experiment tested acknowledgement's impact. Ignored work performed almost identically to shredded work. Managers can demotivate employees simply by ignoring their efforts. Today's knowledge economy demands imagination and engagement, making meaningful work an economic necessity. Walking through IKEA, I bought a Swedish toy chest. Assembly was maddening. Cryptic instructions, missing pieces, parts that didn't fit. Yet once completed, I felt unusual attachment to this furniture. This pride of creation runs deeper than we realize. When instant cake mixes launched in the 1940s, they flopped despite being more convenient. The problem? They were too easy, requiring only water. Once manufacturers required adding eggs, sales exploded. This egg theory showed people need ownership in what they create. Sandra Lee's 70-30 semi-homemade philosophy captures this balance. Using 70% ready-made products with 30% fresh touches allows ownership while saving time. Experiments quantified this IKEA effect. Participants who folded origami frogs valued their creations at 23 cents, while non-creators valued the same amateur work at just 5 cents. Non-creators bid 27 cents for professional origami, close to what creators bid on their own amateur work. We see our clumsy efforts as nearly equal to expert craftsmanship. The twist? Effort only increases attachment when it leads to completion. Those who successfully finished difficult origami valued their work most highly, while those who struggled but failed valued it least. This attachment has a darker side. Presenting research to banking executives, I suggested ways they might help consumers save money. Despite solid data, they seemed uninterested. Was it because the idea wasn't theirs? This not invented here bias, rejecting good ideas simply because we didn't create them, might be as powerful as our attachment to physical objects. Experiments confirmed this. Participants who created solutions rated them as more practical and promising. Even when merely rearranging jumbled words to form our exact solution, they valued their ideas more highly. Thomas Edison exemplifies this bias taken to extremes. His obsession with direct current blinded him to Tesla's superior alternating current. Despite AC's clear advantages, Edison dismissed it as utterly impractical. To discredit AC, he publicly electrocuted stray animals and secretly funded the electric chair. Despite Edison's efforts, AC eventually prevailed, but not before his bias delayed progress and caused suffering. Companies develop cultures around their beliefs, often rejecting external innovations. Sony missed opportunities in MP3 players and flat-screen TVs because of their rejection of outside ideas. Revenge is a primal instinct that, while often destructive, deters wrongdoing and supports cooperation. Brain scans reveal why we pursue revenge even when it hurts us. Punishing wrongdoers activates the striatum, our reward center. We're literally wired to enjoy payback. This isn't uniquely human. German researchers found chimps pull a revenge rope, collapsing a food table when another chimp hoards food unfairly. This similarity suggests revenge maintains social order across species. The 2008 financial crisis triggered widespread revenge desires against bankers. As institutions collapsed and received bailout small awarding outrageous bonuses, public trust shattered completely. Personal experience with Audi inspired research on consumer revenge. When my new car lost power at 70 miles an hour, I narrowly avoided disaster. Customer service responded with indifference, treating my near-death experience as mere inconvenience. Their callous response truly infuriated me. This led to experiments measuring revenge through overpayment returns. While 45% returned extra cash normally, only 14% did after experiencing a brief 12-second interruption, showing how minor annoyances trigger vengeful behavior. Most troubling, revenge seekers don't distinguish between punishing actual offenders or innocent parties. They simply want someone to pay. Fortunately, simple apologies completely counteract this effect, and increasing time between offense and revenge opportunity reduces vengeful feelings. Despite downsides, revenge can be constructive. When Cornelius Vanderbilt discovered associates had sold his steamship company to themselves, he declared, "I'll ruin you," and built a successful rival. After Jeffrey Katzenberg was fired from Disney, he co-founded DreamWorks and released Shrek, parodying Disney's fairy tales with a villain resembling his former boss. Our sensory systems demonstrate remarkable adaptation, functioning across vast ranges and quickly adjusting. After leaving a dark theater, sunshine initially blinds us, then becomes imperceptible. This extends to smells, textures, temperatures, and background noises. Research with severely injured veterans revealed they developed significantly higher pain thresholds, withstanding hot water for nearly 60 seconds versus 27 seconds for those with mild injuries, adaptation lasting years. This hedonic adaptation describes how we emotionally level out over time. Just as we stop noticing new hardwood floors, we adapt to most life changes. Even paraplegia or lottery wins result in happiness levels eventually returning near baseline. We consistently overestimate how long emotions will last, driving the hedonic treadmill, our endless pursuit of possessions providing only temporary happiness. When a new car's excitement fades, we seek the next purchase, perpetually chasing satisfaction without recognizing how quickly we'll adapt. To manage adaptation, understand when to embrace or disrupt it. Counterintuitively, interrupting pleasurable experiences enhances enjoyment by preventing adaptation, while breaking up unpleasant experiences worsens them by resetting adaptation. Slow down pleasure. Buying a couch and television months apart rather than simultaneously maximizes happiness, while making multiple cutbacks at once minimizes suffering. Increase happiness by investing in transient experiences, like travel, rather than constant ones like furniture, introducing unpredictability, and avoiding comparisons. The hedonic treadmill isn't inevitable. Once we understand adaptation, we can design lives maximizing lasting satisfaction. We are not the rational creatures we imagine ourselves to be. Our decisions are shaped by forces we barely recognize. The pressure of incentives that backfire, the meaning we find in effort, the pride we take in creation, the biases that blind us, the revenge that feels satisfying, and the adaptation that makes both joy and suffering temporary. These aren't flaws to eliminate, but features of our humanity to understand and harness. The upside of irrationality isn't abandoning reason, it's embracing a fuller picture of what drives us. Design workplaces for meaning, not just efficiency. Set goals that honor the pride of creation, not just outcomes. Face setbacks with apologies, not revenge. Pursue happiness through experiences and relationships that resist adaptation, not possessions. Understanding our irrationality makes us more effective. It allows us to design environments that work with our nature, make choices that account for our biases, and build lives that satisfy deeper needs rather than surface wants. In a world that treats us as rational calculators, recognizing our beautiful, messy, irrational humanity isn't weakness, it's wisdom. The question isn't whether you'll be irrational. You will be. The question is whether you'll understand your irrationality well enough to make it work for you.